How could the Supreme Court in this country decide that forced sterilizing women was okay? Adam Cohen will tell us about his new book, Imbeciles: The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck.
You know, you can think of these four men as literally slicing her in half, right? Because she's the beginning of the story and the end. And that's what the government did to her, right? They cut into her. So these are four men who interrupt her life and change it profoundly.
Who knew that more than 200 women have run for the American presidency? Ellen Fitzpatrick will join us to talk about her book, The Highest Glass Ceiling.
You know, no one has spent any time writing about them or looking at them in any detail in this context. That was sort of the way they were treated in their own time.
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Adam Cohen joins us now. He is the author of Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck, reviewed this week on our cover by David Oshinsky. Adam, thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
The book is a look at American eugenics, which I think is a phrase that is just startling for people today because most people don't, you know, they associate eugenics with Nazi Germany. But what is the history of eugenics in this country?
Yeah, so it started in England by actually a half-cousin of Charles Darwin. He coined the phrase, came over to America, and it was actually wildly popular in the 1920s. There was this craze, a belief that we could uplift the human race by deciding who would be able to reproduce and who not reproduce.
So it was tied in with the progressive era.
Absolutely. And it was popular in the most elite circles, the most progressive circles. The president of Harvard was a big eugenicist. The president of Stanford was a big eugenicist. And other people, Alexander Graham Bell, Theodore Roosevelt. Some of our leading lights were eugenicists.
And Margaret Sanger,
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the case that is the centerpiece of your book. Who was Carrie Buck?
Carrie Buck was a poor young woman from Charlottesville, Virginia. She'd been raised by a single mother, taken in by a foster family, and then, you know, very tragically, was raped one summer by the nephew of her foster mother. When she got pregnant, the family decided they had to get rid of her. They shipped her off to the Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, where she was declared to be feeble-minded, and she happened to get there just after Virginia had passed its eugenic sterilization law.
Let's go back to who Carrie Buck really was a little bit later, but in terms of the way the court saw her, how did they view her at that time?
They viewed her as being feeble-minded, and this was a very broad category, but it encompassed all kinds of levels of mental defects. So they saw her as someone who was mentally defective and therefore not worthy of reproducing. In fact, there was nothing wrong with her mentally. She had done very well in school until she was pulled out of school. She had good grades. So this was all a misperception, but one that the court system really bought into.
And how did it get up to the Supreme Court?
So the goal was always to create a test case. The state of Virginia, the hospitals, didn't want to begin sterilizing people till they could see that their law had been upheld by the courts.
When you say that the goal was always to find a test case, whose goal was that?
Sure. So in Virginia, there were some states that just began sterilizing people as soon as they passed a law. The state hospitals, under the advice of their lawyer, who's one of the characters in my book, a guy named Aubrey Strobe, they decided we're not going to sterilize anyone until we can tell that the law is constitutional. So the hospitals and the lawyer decided that, and they created a test case, and the decision was made to make Carrie Buck the first person who would be sterilized under the law, so she would be at the center of this case. They gave her a lawyer who was not on her side, and that lawyer took the case to the courts, through the Virginia courts, all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So in 1927, you have Buck versus Bell, and who was on the Supreme Court at that time?
Well, it was a very illustrious lineup. The Chief Justice was William Howard Taft, who had been President of the United States before he was Chief Justice. Louis Brandeis, the great progressive who was known as the People's Attorney before he joined the court, was on the court. And then Oliver Wendell Holmes, who is probably the most legendary Supreme Court justice in American history, he was on the court and he wrote this decision.
And even though you say it was an illustrious court, we should point out that in 1924, there was no Supreme Court official portrait. And why was that?
Yes, because one of the justices was so anti-Semitic that he refused to sit next to Louis Brandeis. There were a couple of raging anti-Semites on the court. There was some racism. It was a weird time, the 1920s.
But Oliver Wendell Holmes generally is a revered person in terms of Supreme Court justices, and he wrote this decision.
He did. And, you know, when I was at Harvard Law School, he was such a respected figure. You could barely turn a corner without seeing a portrait of him on the walls. He was his books have been so acclaimed within the legal academy. He wrote this. He was a eugenicist, and he was from a tradition in Boston, the Boston Brahmins. His father had been the dean of Harvard Medical School, actually coined the phrase Boston Brahmin. They believed that these old families were superior. He was raised to believe that. He wrote about eugenics long before this case came along. And when it came along, he had been trained to believe that people like him were better than people like Harry Bock.
When he wrote the decision, did he base it in this idea of eugenics, of sort of inherently superior people, or was it positioned as a public health issue?
He said that we were in danger of being drowned in a tide of incompetence. He really did believe that there were the competent people like him and the incompetent people. And he really bought into this eugenic idea that we have a national gene pool, and the goal is to make our gene pool better, smarter, fitter, and people like Harry Bock were not part of that.
But I found it interesting that he relied on the case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts. Tell us about that case. And
absolutely
how did
right. Yes, you're right that as a legal matter, he looked to the one precedent that he looked to was a forced vaccination case where the question was whether you could have a law that required people to be vaccinated. And he said that as long as that had been upheld, that therefore, if you can vaccinate people forcibly, you can sterilize them forcibly. It's a terrible analogy for many reasons, including that Massachusetts vaccination law allowed you to opt out of it by paying like $5. But also, obviously, a little shot in the arm, although somewhat invasive, bears no relation to an operation. You know, in the 1920s, surgery was not very sophisticated, a huge operation done by the government, and then it can take weeks to recover, and then you can't have children. Really not analogous.
So Holmes wrote the decision. How did the decision break down among the nine justices?
Yeah, so it was an 8-1 decision. You know, the vast majority joined him. There was one dissenter, Pierce Butler, who was the only Catholic on the court, probably the most conservative member of the court. And the fact that he was Catholic was probably relevant. He didn't write a dissent, so we don't know exactly what he was thinking. But the main group that was opposing eugenic sterilization in the nation at the time was actually Catholics, because a couple reasons. One is the traditional Catholic respect for the reproductive process that we see in abortion, but also Catholics believed that people should be judged on their inherent spirituality, their inherent sense of who they were as a person, not on these physical attributes that the eugenicists were focused on. So when legislatures considered eugenic sterilization laws around the country, Catholic people were the ones who showed up regularly to oppose it, nuns, priests, and Catholic lay people. And there were states like Louisiana with large Catholic populations that voted down their eugenic sterilization laws really because of that Catholic opposition.
You mentioned that Pierre Butler did not write a dissent. Was it hard for you to go back and figure out sort of the process behind this decision? Was there a lot of paperwork? Do we know what Brandeis, for example, thought about the case? Did he write about it?
No, there are huge silences in this case, and there have been large articles written about the silence of Butler. Why didn't he write a decision? What was an opinion? What was he thinking? People don't know what Brandeis was thinking. You know, one theory is that a lot of progressives like him believed in eugenics, so maybe he was a big believer in it, although he didn't talk about it much. Another possibility is he said in an interview later that sometimes he voted with the majority just to be kind of convivial. And the Chief Justice, Taft, was very big on getting big majorities. He liked to twist arms. So it could be that Brandeis was sort of coerced into it. It could have been he was a true believer. But we really don't know. And the biggest biography of Brandeis that came out a few years ago doesn't really talk about it.
There was a book that came out last year by Lisa McGurr on prohibition that sort of reconsidered the way in which the prohibition movement fit into American progressivism overall. And it seems that there's kind of a reconsideration going on of that era. Did this researching this book cause you to look back and see that period differently?
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing I think that, you know, will surprise people that comes out of the book is about the 1924 Immigration Act. We know that in the 1920s, we changed our immigration policy. We closed the door to a lot of immigration. I don't think people realize how much that was eugenically driven, that one of the characters in the book, Harry Laughlin, was actually appointed expert eugenics agent to Congress. So he testified before Congress that certain nationalities were genetically inferior, were a threat to the nation's gene pool. So things like that, I think that eugenics has been so airbrushed out of history that we don't realize that even immigration policies that really helped shape the country were driven by this eugenics craze.
Was there an outcry when this decision came down, or was this sort of accepted as a move forward?
It was generally applauded. Most of the media who reacted positively. The Catholic publications were opposed. There was some opposition, but in general, you know, it's remarkable. I say this as an alumnus of the New York Times and someone who is very proud of my association with it. The New York Times was, at least in some of the feature articles leading up to the decision, they wrote favorably about the Eugenics Record Office, not atypically. That was, you know, the president of Harvard, the president of Stanford. This was something that the elites in our society applauded.
How prevalent did forced sterilization become?
Well, it had already been fairly prevalent before the decision. It started in Indiana in 1907. It got a real boost from this decision. So the following year, Mississippi passed a law. During this eugenics era, probably about 70,000 people were eugenically sterilized. So this is many, many people. And also many more were locked away, like Carrie's mother was locked away in the colony for epileptics and feeble-minded for her entire life. So there were a lot of real victims from this decision.
When you say during this era, what period are we talking about? So the decision happens in 1927. How long does this go on for?
Well, the last eugenic sterilization in the United States, shockingly, was in Oregon in 1981. And by that point, they were fairly rare. But in the 1970s, they were still doing eugenic sterilizations in Virginia. It's really persisted. And even now that that eugenic era is over, you still hear stories about women who are sterilized against their will in prisons and in other contexts like that. So there's still, you know, some subterranean eugenic sterilization going on.
And the law has never been overturned.
That's correct. The Supreme Court had an opportunity to overturn Buck versus Bell in 1942 in another sterilization case. They struck down Oklahoma's law, but on very narrow grounds. And the justice who wrote that decision later said that they wanted to keep Buck versus Bell in place. And as recently as 2001, a U.S. Court of Appeals, that's one step below the Supreme Court in Missouri, cited Buck versus Bell in a case involving the forced sterilization of a mildly retarded woman. So this still is the law.
And there was a cover story recently on New York Magazine about how intelligent do you have to be to raise a child that raised some of these same questions. How is this dealt with now if a person of low IQ, low function becomes pregnant?
Yeah, I mean, these are very complicated issues. And as that article suggested, everyone's still working their way through what is right. And there you also have the interest of the baby, right? You know, anyone has a right to be raised in an acceptable way. But one thing that does make the eugenic era a little different is that here they were less concerned about the child and the family. They were really concerned about the gene pool. It's really this ugly idea that, you know, you are someone who has bad genes because you're deaf or you're dumb or you're feeble-minded or you're an alcoholic or you're poor even, and we don't want your genes, which is just a whole other level of ugliness, really.
But in a way, that might become even more of an issue now that we are, that our understanding of genetics has become so much more advanced. And there is this whole process that is a kind of looming of selecting children based on, selecting embryos based on their genetic makeup.
Absolutely right. So with now in China last year, they edited the human embryo for the first time. So we now are probably, as you suggest, moving into an age of what the media is calling designer babies, where, you know, over time we may be able to choose some of the attributes of our children in a way that will then be genetically passed on. So one thing about that is that it does seem, you know, perhaps like it will usher in a creepy new age of eugenics. But there is also some thought that it could usher in a good age of eugenics. And what I mean by that is when the debate goes on now about human embryo editing, some of the people who support it the most are people who have genetic diseases, terrible diseases that they don't want to pass on to their children. And they say, it would be great if we could edit the embryo so my child doesn't have this serious disease I have. There's going to be a huge discussion over this. It's already started, and the issues are really nuanced and complicated.
Looking at just the mechanics of your book for a second, I'm looking right now at your table of contents, which you organize in a very interesting way. You start off with a chapter about Carrie Buck, and you end with a chapter about Carrie Buck. But in the middle, you have chapters sort of paired by character. You have chapter 2 is called Albert Pretty. Chapter 3 is called Albert Pretty. Chapter 4, Harry Laughlin. Chapter 5, Harry Laughlin. Who are these characters? How did you decide to structure the book around them?
Well, I love this question because it's actually something as a writer you think about a lot. So these were the main characters in the story. And, you know, the title is Imbeciles. And one thing I was trying to do was to show that while they were labeling Carrie Buck an imbecile, in fact, they were the ones who were at least unintelligent religion on this issue. And the quote I have at the beginning is from the Bible: professing to be wise, they became fools. So the idea is that these four men who did this to her were, if not imbeciles, they were the ones who were the most misbegotten in this. And the structure I thought about very carefully, in part because I really wanted this ultimately to be Carrie's story. So we begin by seeing her, meeting her, seeing her plight, and we end with what was done to her. And I actually thought, you know, this is maybe a little bit too deeply structural, but, you know, you can think of these four men as literally slicing her in half, right? Because she's the beginning of the story and the end. And that's what the government did to her, right? They cut into her. So these are four men who interrupt her life and change it profoundly. One other thing about it is I also did this with my last book. I told it through five characters, in part because I try to show that these are decisions that actual people make. I mean, there's a way you can sort of step back and say, oh, everyone got crazy about eugenics. Of course they were going to sterilize Carrie Buck. Well, no, these were individual people, these four people who had the choice to help her or to hurt her, ending with Oliver Wendell Holmes. They chose to hurt her. Let's look at their stories, who they were, why they made this decision. And I hope that the reader will sort of take away from this, you know, we need to think about our own agency and what goes on in society.
You start with Carrie Buck and you end with Carrie Buck. Let's just go back to Carrie. Can you tell us what happened afterwards?
Sure. It's a terribly sad story in many ways. And it starts with the fact that during the proceedings, they said to her that if she were sterilized, she'd be able to be released from the colony and move back in with her foster family, the Dobbs, who were raising her daughter Vivian. But when she was sterilized, they didn't do that. So this was in the briefs that the lawyers wrote on her behalf. But then when she was sterilized, they called up the Dobbs family. They wouldn't take her back. They kept her baby. They wouldn't let her live with them. So she ends up being placed in various households around the state of Virginia, basically as a housekeeper. She gets on with her life. She marries a couple of times. She writes these beautiful letters to the colony, which show that she's not feeble-minded, in which she expresses a lot of concern about how her mother's doing. She sends her mother various foods. She wants to know if her mother can come visit her. At the end of her life, she's interviewed and she says how much she regretted not being able to have babies and how they done her wrong. But one other thing that happens at the end of her life is that people who knew her all agree she was not feeble-minded in any way. At the retirement home where she lived, she used to love getting the newspaper every day.
Did the crossword puzzle.
Did the crossword puzzle, right. So this is someone who was so wronged, not just by history, but by our country and by the Supreme Court.
It's a terrible important story. The book, again, is called Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck by Adam Cohen. Adam, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Pamela.
Alexandra Alter is here now to talk about what's going on in the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What are we going to talk about today?
So a few weeks ago, I came across a really unusual note on a galley. It was a galley of this novel called Dark Debts. And the first thing I noticed was that it was originally published 20 years ago. And I usually don't write about anniversary editions. There's no point. But I'd never heard of this book.
There's no point.
I mean, people will put a new cover on a classic novel. And I'm not, you know, we're not going to write about the latest cover on The Great Gatsby or something like that. But this caught my attention because apparently this woman, Karen Hall, I'd never heard of her. She'd written just one book in her career. She's been a writer for 20 years, and she's been rewriting this book.
For 20 years?
Not for the entire time, but she's been thinking about it. And she tried 25 different first drafts of a sequel. She was just obsessed with everything she sort of got wrong and missed in the first take. And luckily for her, this novel is kind of a strange hybrid of Southern Gothic, and it's a theological thriller, and it's about a Catholic priest who's fighting off demonic forces, sort of in the mode of The Exorcist, but with a little bit of romantic comedy thrown in. It's very unusual. And luckily for her, her editor, Jonathan Karp, who first acquired the book at Random House and edited it there, was equally obsessed with the book. He has told me he'd never stopped thinking about it over 20 years. He, you know, begged her for another book. He really wanted to keep the momentum going because she was sort of made a splash with it in 1996.
So it did well?
It did well. You know, it wasn't a blockbuster, but it was certainly a cult hit. And finally, when she got back in touch with him 2 years ago and said they want to do an audio drama of the book, he suggested an anniversary edition. She said, well, I only want to do that if I can rewrite it, you know, entirely. And he loved the idea. He said to me in an interview, you know, there are so many writers that write too many books. And I like the fact that she has one story and she's sticking to it. And, you know, why wouldn't you go back and fix all the mistakes you made? So the book has a completely different ending. One of the major characters was cut. A new major character was added. All the profanity was scrubbed out. A lot of the violence
was
toned down.
That was like because of a relative, right? Did not like all that?
Her mother, who's 91, said, please, I want my friends to be able to read this book this time.
That is too funny.
So she joked, well, actually her editor joked that for the next 20th anniversary edition, they can put it all back in.
That's right.
Because the mother won't be around. But the other thing that happened to her in the last 20 years, a lot of things happened because of the book. Her high school boyfriend got back in touch when the book was published. He emailed her through her publisher's website, and they're now married. They've been married for 16 years.
This book has become her life.
She converted to Catholicism in the course of researching it, and that was one of the reasons she wanted to rewrite it, because she felt like there were things about the faith that she didn't get right. Mm-hmm. Her understanding has deepened. And after this, the story came out, it sort of raised a lot of questions. I got a lot of kind of messages about it from writers saying, yeah, it's weird that this doesn't happen more often, particularly now that you can publish books digitally. I mean, some writers do get, you know, when the rights revert to them, they'll self-publish a book and tweak it in various ways.
Right. But there's always like that period between hardcover and paperback where you can go back and fix some typos and correct minor errors. But
yeah, typically they will just correct errors, typos, and things like that. You don't get these entire revisions.
This isn't the only new book that's making very, very significant changes in a reissue.
That's true. I think you'll see this kind of thing happening more in nonfiction. But another example this spring that's coming out is the biography of Harper Lee that Charles Shields published years ago. And of course, since that book came out, so much has happened with her legacy and life. And she died last month. But he was able to add, I think, several more chapters about Ghost at a Watchman and all the controversy surrounding that second novel that was so unexpected, how it has changed our understanding of her life in Alabama and her relationship with her father and all these things. So it's going to be a very different biography, and that will be coming out later this year.
If only we could go back and rewrite all our newspaper articles.
I never want to go back and even read them.
All right, Alexandra, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Ellen Fitzpatrick joins us now. Her new book is The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Ellen, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Could this book be any more timely?
It is indeed timely. I didn't know when I began writing it whether a woman would be running in 2016. So I suspected that might be the case, but I wasn't sure. So I'm glad that it all came together in the way that it has.
When did you start writing it?
A year and a half ago, I guess, I began sketching out the project.
So it was post-Hillary 2008. Did that, in part, inspire the book?
Well, it's funny. I got the idea for this book one day. I was sort of searching around for a new book project that would engage me as much as the last book I wrote did. And I literally, one morning, I just swung my legs over the side of the bed and I sat there and I thought, gee, you know, we know very little about women who have run for the presidency in the past. They've been largely dismissed as trivial, unimportant, marginal. They were not successful, obviously. The interesting thing was that the historiography, in a sense, resembled the phenomenon itself. That is, these women who really never have been taken very seriously by academic historians, at least. You know, no one has spent any time writing about them or looking at them in any detail in this context. And that was sort of the way they were treated, at least some of them, in their own time. So there was a kind of mirroring of the reality of the substance of their experience and the way they have not kind of come down in history.
Well, I think Americans are famous historical amnesiacs. And you always hear, Hillary, the first woman running for the presidency. I still think that even those of us who know that she's not the first woman to run for the presidency, that many people would be surprised to know that there are more than 200 women who have run.
Yes, that was actually very surprising to me. There's a big sort of library volume that I spent some time with that details the names of pretty much anyone who ever appeared on a ballot or whose name was ever put in nomination by a third party. It goes through each election, through all of American history. I began looking through that, and I started seeing the names of these women. I had some help with a research assistant as well, and we went through this almanac and put together a list, and there were over 200 names of women who surface as somehow involved in presidential politics, usually in small third parties, and they didn't gain much traction, which is why I decided to focus on the three women who really did stimulate a conversation about women in presidential politics through their candidacies.
The three women, just quickly, are Victoria Woodhull, Margaret Chase Smith, and Shirley Chisholm. But let's start with Victoria Woodhull, who is quite a character.
She certainly was. She's a great figure, and she's well known to historians of women. And there's been a lot written about her. There's some excellent biographies of her. But she's mostly known as a feminist, a free love advocate. She's a very colorful and radical figure in women's history. And most people that have written about her have treated her presidential run as somewhat of a footnote. It's not everyone has treated it that way, but largely it was seen as sort of quixotic and really kind of a footnote to a much larger, bigger life. But the presidential run really was quite significant in the arc of all of her activities.
So she nominates herself in 1870. For what party and what's her goal other than to be president? What was her candidacy about?
Well, her candidacy was really about women's trying to advance women's equality. And the fascinating thing about her is that she emerges in the context of Reconstruction, when the nation is debating how to put the country back together again after the Civil War and to deal with the legacies of slavery. And it's during this period that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution are both debated and then eventually ratified. And in that moment, when the whole nation was in some sense reeling, the women's rights activists saw this as a time to try to press the case of women's suffrage. And Victoria Woodhull gets involved with them. But she has a remarkable insight, which is that it's not enough simply to try to get women included in these new constitutional amendments, which didn't happen, to try to get women's suffrage rights that way. She has the idea that if you have a candidate, a person that embodies the cause, you might be able to get people to rally around that candidate. And so she presents herself as that candidate, even though women couldn't vote then. She said there was no reason why she couldn't be voted for. This woman obviously did not lack self-esteem. There was an enormous grandiosity at the heart of this, but she was quite a remarkable person. She and her sister were the first women to set up a brokerage firm on Wall Street. She had made a tremendous amount of money. She was very wealthy. She was able to self-finance her campaign at a time when, of course, campaigns weren't as expensive as they are today, but she founded a newspaper to promote her own candidacy. She got quite a bit of attention.
She's such a colorful character, was also a clairvoyant. There's so much to talk about her, but I want to move on to your next woman, Margaret Chase Smith, running as a Republican from Maine. Tell us a little bit about her and why and when she ran.
Well, Margaret Chase Smith was a very interesting woman, extremely accomplished. She served longer in the Senate than any woman in the 20th century, and her constituents in Maine turned her back, put her back into office term after term. She actually entered electoral politics through her husband, and this was a classic way that women could advance in national politics in a way. The custom was called the widow's mandate. Her husband was a congressman, and he became very ill at a point when he was coming up for re-election. He dies in office, but before he dies, he releases a statement saying that he hopes that people will vote for his wife in his place. The Republican Party in Maine acceded to this, as the party sometimes did, as a kind of tribute to to the deceased. And the idea is that the women will serve as placeholders, and then they'll get out of the way when an appropriate male can be found to elect to the full term. Well, she wasn't willing to get out of the way, so she does get elected to the Congress in 1940, and she stays in. She's reelected, runs in 48, goes to the Senate, and remains there. And then in 1964, decides the next logical step is, you know, why not run for president? She was greatly admired and had a very successful run, was very experienced. She wasn't a darling of the Republican Party because she was so unpredictable. One of the advantages of the marginalization of a woman like Margaret Chase Smith was that the party did fairly little to support her, so mm-hmm. she didn't feel terribly beholden to the Republican Party in voting as they wished her to. One of her colleagues said, if she votes with us, it's a coincidence. In 64, she decides she's going to compete in the Republican primary.
Was her candidacy taken seriously?
Not very. And what's shocking about her is that in some ways, the response to her candidacy in 1964, there's more sexism apparent than there was in the discussion of Victoria Woodhull in the early 1870s. And in 64, the sexism was absolutely extraordinary in the response to her. And people who wrote about her, pundits, columnists, and so forth, seemed completely unconscious of it.
Yes.
And they made a very big deal about her age. She was 66. So one minute she's figuring in the Gallup poll as among the most admired women in the world by Americans. The next minute she's being depicted as, you know, sort of addled, menopausal. How can we trust a woman of her age in the Oval Office? You know, could a woman really take on these responsibilities? I mean, it was kind of shocking considering that, you know, it's really kind of the beginning of second wave feminism in this period.
I want to go to the next woman who takes it another step further by being not only a woman, but also African-American, Shirley Chisholm, who
yes.
Runs in 1972 for the Democratic nomination. Tell us about that.
Great woman, a very interesting woman. She had come up through Democratic politics in Brooklyn, and she has a very interesting story because she belongs to an insurgency among African Americans who managed to overthrow the Irish-dominated Democratic Club in Brooklyn and take control of the district that Bedford-Stuyvesant was in.
One of the craziest things, I think, in your book is that coming from Bed-Stuy, that when she gets to Washington, they immediately put her on the Agriculture Committee.
Right. Yes, and she famously said that it seemed as if all they knew about Brooklyn and Washington was that a tree grew there, which is why they put her on the Agriculture Committee, referring to Betty Smith's wonderful novel, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Right.
She was very outspoken, and she, Shirley, was right out there with it, and she called it like she saw it. And it was, of course, a very different political moment, because after 1968, the rules of the Democratic Party changed, and provisions were put into place to ensure that more African Americans and minorities and women would be represented at the political conventions after the disastrous 1968 election. And so Shirley is both part of this insurgency that happens in New York politics, and then she gets into Congress that way, and then she very much sees her moment at hand as things are changing within the Democratic Party and sees a way in which maybe a woman candidate can rise in this fashion. And she went out on the hustings and campaigned, self-financed. It was she was charging this to her American Express card.
Wow.
Yeah, in a period when her competitors were spending, you know, $1 million each, and that's nothing compared to what it all costs today.
Right. What was the reaction in the press like to her candidacy?
People people came right out and said, well, she can't be elected. She's black and she's a woman. I mean, you know, this is ridiculous on the face of it.
Yeah.
That was right out there. And she was often quoted as saying that she had faced more discrimination in American politics as a woman than she did as an African American. But what she found, in some sense, really disheartening, were that progressives did not support her as fully as she thought they ought to. One could argue the case from their point of view, which was she clearly was very much a long shot, and they felt that it was imperative to defeat Richard Nixon. But she was really disgusted that some leading feminists who would stand on the dais with her and say, oh, it's wonderful, we have to have a woman president, they didn't support her as vociferously as she felt they should. Or they kind of waffled. They said, you know, we think she's the best woman candidate, but we also like George McGovern, who turned out to be a surefire loser in that election.
In looking at these three women in particular, and obviously the current election, how much of what's happening to Hillary Clinton now seems like, you know, deja vu?
You know, there's a lot of resonance. There's several through lines that run through the story. The kinds of concerns about her age and her temperament. Public opinion polls today show that most Americans have, at least will say that they have no problem at all in the idea of electing a woman as president. And in fact, many people express enthusiasm for it. But it always comes down to a question of, you know, today many people will say, well, I'm all in favor of a woman president, I just don't want this woman. And that's fair enough. You know, voters have their preferences. There's no reason why anybody, virtually all of these candidates, would say, don't vote for me simply because I'm a woman. But on the other hand, there are some resonances in the way that they were perceived that run through time. The obverse of this is also interesting, which is the way in which Hillary Clinton has overcome the various obstacles that stood in the way of her predecessors. And that, I think, is quite compelling and fascinating.
All right. Well, ongoing story. Obviously, we don't know the ending, but thank you so much. Ellen Fitzpatrick is the author of The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Ellen, thank you again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Greg Coles is here now with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
There's a lot on the list this week that's new.
Yeah, you know how a few years back we added a series list on the children's side of things?
That was more than a few years, Greg Coles, showing your age. Yes.
It may be time to do something similar on the adult side, because all five of the new titles on this week's hardcover fiction list are series novels.
All right. Starting, let's go through the very familiar books then.
Starting down at number 11, J.A. Jantz has the 11th book in her Allie Reynolds series. It's called Clawback, new at number 11. Then at number 8, Donna Leon continues her Commissioner Guido Brunetti series. That's the series of mysteries set in Venice, called The Waters of Eternal Youth, new at number 8. Then just above it, new at number 7, Jeffrey Deaver returns with his Lincoln Rhymes series with a novel called The Steel Kiss, new at number 7. New at number 2, Patricia Briggs is back with her Mercy Thompson series, a novel called Fire Touched, new at number 2. And new at number 1, C.J. Box is back with the latest Joe Pickett novel. This is the 16th in that series, called Off the Grid, new at number 1.
I had dinner the other night with a fantasy writer who shall go unnamed, but writes been in the midst of a very, very long series, and she was so relieved to be done with it. She was, you know, free to do anything.
I think, you know, even for somebody as successful as, for instance, J.K. Rowling, the series becomes a little bit of a burden. You know, the fans get so immersed in the world, and the writer has to start thinking, maybe more about the readers than about the world they've created themselves. And fans start calling them out on inconsistencies.
Right. There are a lot of details to keep track of.
Yeah.
All right. What's on nonfiction?
Nonfiction, there are three new titles this week. Starting down at number 14 with a writer I was a little bit surprised to see had never been on the list because she's written a couple of cookbooks and she's a TV celebrity. Padma Lakshmi, the host of Top Chef on Bravo for going back, I think, 11 years now. Has a memoir called Love, Loss, and What We Ate. It goes back, it looks at her life growing up in South India and her kind of famous and short-lived marriage to Salman Rushdie, and then how she got more and more involved in the TV food world. She's not a chef herself. She's just a home cook, but she had a show on the Food Network called Padma's Passport, kind of looking at global cuisine. And then, of course, she really broke out big in Top Chef as a judge and as the host of that show. So Love, Loss, and What We Ate, new at number 14. Then at number 8, Lawrence B. Lindsay, who is an economist and a bit of a government bureaucrat. He was the former director of the National Economic Council. He was an assistant to President George W. Bush on economic policy.
That's a sure path to the bestseller list.
He has a book arguing against government bureaucracy and government bloat. It's, you know, an election year argument for smaller government called Conspiracies of the Ruling Class. And it's really kind of an analysis of how government is bigger than it needs to be. That's new at number 8. And finally, maybe a book that pairs well with Conspiracies of the Ruling Class. If you're interested in smaller government, you might also be interested in Smarter, Faster, Better, which is the title of the new book by Charles Duhigg.
Our very own.
Yes. He also, of course, wrote The Power of Habit, which was a longtime bestseller and may, in fact, still be on the paperback list. I know it's been kicking around there recently. Smarter, Faster, Better looks at the science of productivity, and it makes its debut on the hardcover nonfiction list at number 6.
All right. Well, congratulations to our very own Charles Duhigg. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.